This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Brian Ballo is a professor of history at the University of Virginia, and he's one of the history guys on Backstory Radio. You can check him out online at backstoryradio.org and hear it on any of your NPR stations here throughout Virginia. Brian, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be here, Coy.
Thanks for coming in. We're gonna talk this hour about politics and democracy and technology. And we were talking off the air about a class that you're teaching this year on digital politics. And what exactly is that?
Well, the class is called Digitizing America, 1980 to the Present. And it's not just about digital politics. It's about America from 1980 to the present. But I kind of use the lens of this information revolution, especially the digital technology, the rise of digital technology, starting really with satellite TV and cable TV, moving through the internet, eventually the World Wide Web. We actually, you know, historians always go backwards first, Coy. So
yeah.
we're in the third week of the course, and we're just getting to the 1960s, even though it starts in 1980. I'm sure my students are very confused. But you know, you take a history course, you just kind of got to expect to go backwards first. That's what we do.
Of course, yes, and that's what you're so good at, and that's one reason we always look forward to talking with you. So as a way of introduction to this subject, I spoke yesterday with one of your colleagues, Sidney Milkus. He was kind to join us live in studio to talk about his fascinating new book on Theodore Roosevelt and the presidential campaign of 1912. And he was telling us that that year was a real turning point in terms of politics and technology, because it was the first year that the use of phonographs and mm-hmm. recordings, both sound and film recordings, mm-hmm. actually became part of the campaign. And people could hear these speeches, people that had never heard a speech and maybe just, you know, heard other people talking about it or read something in a newspaper. For the first time, they could actually hear Theodore Roosevelt talking or see a film of one of the presidential candidates. So that really was, in terms of the 20th century and the beginning of what we're going to talk about today.
Yep.
Do you recognize that year, that presidential year, as sort of the beginning, as this turning point away from the sort of 19th century to the 20th century?
It all depends what you're measuring. Sid's a terrific scholar, and I think that photographs and recordings were important. But, you know, in the 1920s, they were saying, hey, it's all about film. And then in the 1930s, they were saying it's all about radio. So, sure, 1912, I know this much, 1912 comes before the 20s.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that happened at the beginning of the century. But, you know, there were new ways of producing newspapers, and they were appealing to new kinds of readerships in the 1890s and 1900s. Everybody thought the telegraph was going to revolutionize politics. You know, in fact, it had an impact. So Sid's absolutely right to focus on these still photographs and recordings. What I think is very interesting is how long it takes politicians to adapt to these new technologies, to figure out how they can use them in an interesting way. And I hope we get to talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely.
For the 1980s and, yeah, and 1990s.
So let's start with, where should we start? Should we start with television?
Yeah, I think TV's a good place to start because, you know, Americans started really watching television, owning televisions in the mid-50s, with the number of TVs growing by the tens of millions each year. And by the 1960s, early 1960s, they started watching news regularly on television. The event, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners can remember this, the event that really marked supposedly a new era in television was that debate a series of debates between Kennedy and Nixon. And the fact that Nixon, on the substance, actually did quite well. People who listened on the radio thought, you know, when they were polled, said Nixon won the debate, but people who watched on TV saw Kennedy cool, calm, you know, saw Nixon's midnight shadow. And from that point on, and, you know, all of these all of these are kind of caricatures. They become larger than life. Just like today, people are saying, oh, yeah, it's all about social networking. Well, it's had an impact, but it's not quite as large as people think. So, you know, TV wasn't a deal maker, but politicians began to think that it was. And from that point on, we started getting lots of advertising on television, and we frankly got candidates made for television. Increasingly, we got folks like movie actors like Ronald Reagan, like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. We're talking with Brian Ballow, professor of history at the University of Virginia, and he is one of the history guys on Backstory Radio, backstoryradio.org. The phone lines are open throughout this hour at 977-1070 if you have a question or you want to join the conversation. So that year, what was the year of that debate again?
That was in 1960.
60.
Yeah.
But it still took a while for candidates to really take advantage of television.
It took them. And I actually think that even more important development for politics in many ways than these debates and advertising. Of course, advertising and TV has become a staple and they become much better at it. But for the political system in general, I think the inception or the broad use of cable TV and satellite TV has made a huge difference. Because you're too young to remember this, Coy. I don't think you're older than 28 years old looking. Too bad.
25.
Too bad your listeners can't see how young and boyish you are. But you know, there used to be the three networks. There was, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS. And what happens when you only have three outlets and millions of viewers is that those outlets, those networks, on something like the evening news, they really needed to stick close to the middle. Because if they didn't capture the broad middle, if they only appealed to one of the fringes on the left or the right, they were dead meat in terms of ratings.
Yeah.
Okay? So you get cable TV, you get satellite TV, you begin to get the 24/7 news cycle with CNN. And as you begin to get all of these outlets, you know what? You can be quite successful if you capture 20% of the market, or maybe 15% of the market, or maybe 11% of the market, the more and more outlets you get. And now, if you add in the World Wide Web, where a lot of people get their news, you know, you can be very successful if you just capture a sliver of the market. And what that means for politics is both good and bad. It means that there can be much more diversity, and you can still be commercially successful. But it also means that increasingly folks can simply listen to the point of view they choose to, the point of view that they prefer.
Yeah.
And that's why you get much more partisanship in the media. That's why you have, you know, Fox News on the right and CNBC, and you know, you pick your channel according to your pre-existing political preference. Now, what's really funny to me as an historian is, where does that leave us? You know, here in the 21st century, it takes us back to the 19th century, where people got their news from newspapers, and where newspapers were highly partisan. I mean, they're very upfront, very obvious about it, especially early 19th century. You had your, you know, your Republican papers, your Whig papers, you know, your Democratic paper. I mean, you know, you would never think of reading a paper from the opposition. Why would you? You wanted your views reinforced. And that's kind of what we're heading back to.
It is interesting that we've gone back to sort of the Jefferson era, the newspaper wars of the 1890s, when a newspaper was...
Was 1790s.
Yeah, I'm sorry, 1790s, when newspapers were decidedly partisan.
Yeah, that was what politics was. And there's, you know, there's something very healthy about that. If you believe that really laying your views out, a vigorous exchange of views, you know. Look, people, by the end of the 19th century, the participation rates in the North were sky high. Everybody voted, at least all eligible white men.
Yeah.
So that's who was eligible, right? Today, you know, we have to make Herculean efforts to achieve a 50% participation rate. So when, you know, along with passion and animation, comes involvement in people. That's the good news.
Yeah.
The bad news is it kind of tends to promote people screaming at the president of the United States, you're a liar.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
That's not the only factor. There are many other reasons for the kind of partisanship.
You put people in these bubbles then where they're constantly surrounded by an echo chamber with people they agree with, and they consume media that tells them you're right to feel that way and to think
that.
That's
right.
And they're never challenged.
Their views are reinforced, and you can very easily feel that you subscribe to the majority view when you might really subscribe to a view that only represents 10 or 11% of the people. On the other hand, we have this constitution that protects minorities, and I believe in protecting minority views. Folks who have fringe views should be allowed to express themselves.
Yeah.
That's the good thing about the internet, but it can reinforce notions of power that don't really correspond to reality.
Yeah, and it silos people off into these niches. Echo chambers.
Right. So you mentioned echo chambers, and that term, you know, comes from a book that compares echo chambers to street corners. And on the street corner, you don't know who you're going to run into, right? You look left, you're right, you look right. You run into all kinds of different people. And, you know, when people used to read a newspaper, even if it was leaning to the left, like the Washington Post over the last 50 years, or leaning to the right, like the Chicago Tribune over the last 50 years, they still would be exposed to kind of a pretty broad variety. It would feel more like a street corner. You weren't quite sure who'd you run into there. Whereas these echo chambers that you refer to, they're self-selected and self-reaffirming.
Yeah, and there's no doubt what political bent you're experiencing when you consume that media and you put yourself in one of those
chambers.
So
to get back to the technology in all of this, as technology offers us all of these different channels, it really does allow for the expression in a commercial system, in a system that's driven by profit largely, it really allows places to survive that only capture 5 or 6% of the market. One of the movies I show in my class is called Ed TV. It's about reality.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
TV.
With Matthew McConaughey.
They choose this guy just because, you know.
Funny movie.
And at one point, the producer, Ellen DeGeneres, says, hey, you know, we only got to get 2% of the market. We don't have to get 100%. We just got to get that 2% that thinks this guy's cute, whatever. You can do very different programming. There's some really good things about that, right? I mean, we haven't talked about the web yet, but with the web, it doesn't cost Amazon to find out what people want and then go get the book. You know, all of this is done virtually. They don't have to stock the book in a bookstore and, you know, pay top dollar for, you know, commercial real estate and all that. Well, there's a better chance that they won't remainder one of my old books, you know, that no one's going to read in a million years. But all they need is that couple of odd people who can find it on the web.
Yeah.
So it's still around.
And this is, of course, you're speaking to what's been called the long tail phenomenon, that that you don't need a huge number of people anymore to have a commercial success.
Exactly.
with cable or satellite or the internet. You just need a few.
And then, you know, that long tail, I like to call it the wide tie. You know, my wife makes fun of me. What do you need all those ties in your closet? I said, I'm not going out and paying $42 just because ties get thin. I'm keeping all those ties because they're going to come back. And with the wide tie phenomenon, you can keep all that around. You never know when a book that, you know, had been written off years ago, all of a sudden something happens in the news, it's back in style, and you know, you got a bestseller on your hand.
So we're talking with Brian Ballow at the University of Virginia. Is this good for democracy? Is this good for America, what's happening? I mean, we're talking about going back to the media environment of the 18th century. Is this a good thing, or should we be bemoaning this fact?
We historians, that's above my pay grade, Coy. But since we're on radio, I'll answer it. Here's what's good about it. I do think it draws more people in. For instance, Pew does these wonderful surveys of media use, especially digital media use, and they are finding that increasing numbers of young people are using social networks. So there's all this, you know, MySpace, this kind of thing, to post political messages or messages having to do with civic engagement, that it's kind of drawing young people who vote in very low numbers, it's kind of drawing them back into the political system. So I would say, from the perspective of participation, if we want a democracy where all Americans participate, then I would say it's a good thing. Another good thing
is, because it opened more doors of entry.
It opens more doors, and it draws people in. It grabs people. One of the reasons I use a lot of media in my class, I intersperse it with my lectures. Well, in my case, it wakes them up when they've fallen asleep from my lectures. But it grabs people, and then you don't know where they're going to go once they're grabbed. But we're nowhere when people don't participate at all, in my view. The other thing is that it promotes exchange. Television perhaps was the low point. You know, you had the television on, people were passive. I talk back to my TV all the time, but it really doesn't do me any good.
Sure, sure.
As we move to the internet, as we move to the web, as we move to wireless internet, cloud computing, these kinds of things, there are many more ways for people to actually engage each other and have a conversation, have a back and forth. So if you define democracy not as taking a public opinion poll of what everybody thinks at 2:22 on Saturday, but as the outcome of deliberation and debate and how people form opinions based on that debate, then I think this digital media is very good.
Yeah.
What's bad are the very echo chambers that we've talked about, the ability to pre-select. And you know, to be specific for your listeners, echo chambers can be a certain blog, they can be a certain website. You know, the people who don't believe that Obama was born in the United States, the birthers. There's all kinds of websites where they can go, and even though this has been proven over and over again, they can go to the websites they like and see the latest conspiracy theory on how Obama is not American.
Just enough to make them feel like they're right.
They're legitimate. Yeah. They're right, and they know other people. They meet other people on that site. They might not know anybody who works next to them at work, which used to be one of the places we talked about things, but who cares? You go to your website, and there are thousands of people who think like they do. That's not such a good thing, I would say, for democracy. And by the way, it happens as much on the left as it happens on the right. I mean, there are people who believe that 911 is a gigantic conspiracy. I probably shouldn't say this because now we'll only get phone calls from people who believe in either one of these conspiracies.
You know, one of my concerns, though, Brian, though, is that with this long tail of media and with this, you know, niching of putting people in little echo chambers where they're only consuming the media that makes them feel like they're right, it makes it so much easier then to demonize the people that aren't part of your group.
Well,
this at the same time that you're increasing exchange, you're increasing the level of vitriol and demonizing somebody just because you disagree on politics, which for me is, you know, for goodness sakes, just because you don't agree on politics, it's no reason to demonize another American.
Right. And what you didn't say, but where you're going, Coy, is it's especially easy when none of this is human interaction, when it's all a couple of keystrokes, when it's all bits and bytes, and it's not sitting across a table face-to-face. Now, having seen some of the coverage of the town hall meetings, certainly this vitriol can seep into public appearances.
Very much so, yeah.
As well. Nonetheless, I think most of us really modify our behavior when we're forced to have a conversation across the table or face-to-face. You know, on the other hand, we live in we have 300 million people. We live in a mass democracy. How do you communicate in a democratic republic our size?
Yeah. We're talking with UVA historian Brian Ballow. Honored to have him live in studio. We're going to take a break now for local news and weather here at the bottom of the hour. And Brian, when we get back, let's talk more in depth about the internet and its effect on politics and democracy. We're talking digital politics with Brian Ballow. This is Charlottesville Right Now. Let's rejoin our conversation with UVA historian Brian Ballow. We're talking digital politics, past, present, and future. And Brian, let's talk about the internet and how arguably politicians were sort of slow on the uptake to really grab it and take advantage of it.
Well, they couldn't really figure out how to use it. Now, fortunately, I had lunch with a really superb politician today, Congressman Leach, who was on the Hill for 30 years, represented a district in Iowa. So I'd never met him before, but I don't like to waste a lot of time. I said, Congressman, you know, I'm going to put you to work. I got to appear on this radio show today, and I want to know, you know, how did the internet change your life in Congress? And he said, I have one word for you, and that's listmanship.
Listmanship.
He said, oh, yeah, politics is all about lists. And, of course, we always used to keep lists, letters we got, donors, all kinds of lists. But with the rise of the internet and, you know, what do we call these group emails? Listservs.
Right.
It became so much easier to keep track of all of these lists on both sides. It was kind of like the Cold War. Interest groups geared up. Millions of emails now instead of dozens of letters. So congressional staffs, you know, had to fight back by categorizing all these. So his and every staff kept a counter list in order to combat the lists that he was on from the interest groups. And he said it really changed the nature of politics because of the scale. You are now dealing with just hundreds of thousands of emails and interest groups that really you'd never heard from before. And of course, on the counter side, whenever a representative voted the way that some interest groups wanted them to, all those interest groups got emails back based on the counter lists. Now, we know that you can't make everybody happy. So the folks that weren't on that side, they never heard back from the congressman. And so it becomes a battle of the lists. And this is, he said, this is how a lot of his colleagues actually thought about, measured politics, that kind of thing. He also had, I thought, just a really, really keen insight into how politics used to be very local. You'd hear from your constituents, you know, they'd say, you know, the Veterans Affairs off down the street, they're not doing their job. I got there, they closed early. What are you going to do about it? Tip O'Neill, all politics is local.
Yeah, yeah.
He said by the time he retired just a few years ago, because of the World Wide Web, he's now just as likely to hear about the war in Iraq or something going on in Afghanistan or hunger in Africa from his own constituents in Iowa as he is to hear about something local. And here's the really keen observation he made. I mean, this guy should be a historian. He said, you know, in the Constitution, the assumption is that it's going to be the executive branch that controls knowledge, that is it's always going to have access to more knowledge, more information. And that's certainly been true for much of the 20th century. That's where the large bureaucracies grew up. That's where the large staffs. And he said, with the rise of the internet and World Wide Web, he is getting information directly, not from his staff. I said, oh, well, you have staff. He said, no, not from my staff, from my constituents, because they have all of this access, and Congress is the first to hear from the people. So I thought those were... I thought that was a useful lunch.
Absolutely. So it's just a way of leveraging your power
as a
representative to ask all your folks to stay in touch with you and send you information.
Exactly.
It's very powerful. I'm reminded of my days in Senator Thurmond's office as a page back in the summer of 1982.
I'm sure you were a really important page.
Oh, absolutely. There was so much of our day that was just spent reading all the hometown newspapers.
Right.
That was it. And we would cut out the articles.
You cut it, cut and paste, right?
And put them in the right folder. And, you know, they would go up the chain. And if it was something important, it eventually got to his desk. But that was it. There was no internet. We were just literally reading and cutting articles out of newspapers.
But Coy, you know, you thought you were working for the senator, but in fact, you were working for future historians. Because when we go into the archives, those compilations of news articles along issue lines that we happen to be studying. They're gold mines.
Right,
we
right.
love those staffers who put them together for us.
I'm also reminded, we're talking about how, and we're talking with UVA's Brian Ballow, you were saying how this politics used to be so local. My dad, of course, was chief of staff for Senator Thurman for and on his personal staff for about 30 years. And Thurman used to have what in the office was called Bride's Day. And every week they would scan the local hometown newspapers and he would call the brides, the connected brides, the one that he needed to talk to. And he would just say, hey, Mary, just wanted to congratulate you on getting married this coming weekend. Nancy and I wanted to be there, but we won't be able to be there. I'm so sorry. I'm going to have somebody send you a gift from us and hope you have a great day.
Yeah.
Every week he would go down a list and work that.
And, that's, and I'll bet he did. Funerals. I bet he wrote
yeah,
personal
there was another
notes
day a week where
people,
he would call and express his sympathies if somebody passed away.
Yeah.
But it was just all out of newspapers.
Right.
Newspapers and the phone.
So given that and given tradition, when the internet came in, especially when it came to using it for elections, I think that politicians were a little slow on the uptake. They knew it was important. They couldn't quite figure out how to use it. And the World Wide Web and social networking has been around for about 10 or 12 years now. The web longer, social networking 10 or 12 years ago. I think, you know, as an historian, I'd kind of date just the way Sid Milkus dated the importance of photographs and, you know, still pictures and audio recordings to the Roosevelt campaign. I date the first really effective use of the World Wide Web and social networking back to Howard Dean's campaign a little more than 4 years ago. We all remember the scream.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
We remember the air going out of the Dean balloon. But how did Dean get to that place? He used a social networking mechanism, a site called meetup.com. You can Google it. It's still there. And he used that to connect kind of the global and the local. He used it so that Dean supporters could identify themselves in a specific area, in a specific region. So we tend to think of the World Wide Web as disembodied, disconnected. Meetup.com uses the web to let people who live near each other meet over common interests. Now, if you go to meetup.com, you'll see, you know, everything in the world, the Chihuahua lovers of San Diego.
Right.
Right. You know, and in fact, Dean supporters became the second most frequent user of meetup.com. That's the good news. You want to guess who the most common user was?
Of meetup, I have no idea.
The Wiccans, the witches.
Oh, you're kidding.
No. So, you know, and that's the wacky thing about the using the web, the social network. It's a process. It's a media. The substance can be just about anything.
Yeah.
But Dean's campaign, and again, this is always going to be more effective in primaries than general elections, because in primaries, as you know, you grew up in a political family, you're really talking about turning out true believers. Turnout is low, and it doesn't take that many people. So if you can identify those folks who are supporting you and let them identify themselves to each other, then you're really on to something,
yeah.
And Dean mastered that. Now, of course,
he also mastered it as a way to raise money too, because he had so many people then giving just a little bit each,
right?
Which Barack Obama then did
because
in his
they were involved, and that's how he was able to raise so much. And then Barack Obama took that. I mean, Dean did scream; the air did go out of the balloon, and you know everybody forgot it. And you know, you would think that from the very start, every candidate would have picked up where Dean left off, but they didn't. I mean, Hillary Clinton's campaign pretty much wrote off the internet, both as a fundraising mechanism and a social networking mechanism. They didn't write it off. They tried, but they didn't put that much into it. Barack Obama did from the very start. He started the My Obama, and I went to the site, and it was remarkable. I mean, you can identify, I don't know if you ever went there, but you could identify people in your neighborhood, 5 mile distance, 10 mile distance. You could identify all the Obama events. It literally connected you to what was going on among other Obama supporters. And it was a very effective tool. Now remember, Obama's campaign was also a 50-state campaign. And how do you campaign in 50 states? You use this social networking. So in places like Montana, Wyoming, really sparsely populated places, you can reach a lot of people at a very, very low cost.
Which is something the Democrats had given up. They'd given up going into states like Virginia where they didn't think they could win. And if I'm not mistaken, it was Howard Dean. That was one of his ideas. We are going to We are going to go fight in places like Virginia.
That's right.
And we're going to fight in all 50 states and do something different. And it worked.
No, it did work. Now, here's the flip side. I mean, there's what most people don't realize is that all the data you accumulate during the election, if you win, that's still right there. So using a very old technology paper, I brought in a copy of the email that Barack Obama, it was in my inbox. I got in early this morning. It was here. Okay, so he sent this to me at 10:54 p.m. And it's, Brian, you know, how cool that President and I are on a first-name basis. I'll still call him President Obama, okay? I just finished laying out my plan for health reform at a joint session of Congress. Now I'm writing directly to you because what happens next is crucial. All of this is because, as a researcher, I visited myobama.com to kind of check out social networking for politics. And, of course, you can guess the gist of this. The gist of this is I click on a hyperlink, and it takes me to a letter. And here it is. Here's my representative. I live in Louisa County. Eric Cantor, Jim Webb, Mark Warner. And my letter is written for me, right? Please support President Obama's plan for health reform. Right? All I got to do
just
is
click, click, click.
Click, click, click. And fill out my name.
You're participating in democracy.
And this koi feeds on itself because if I send that letter, if I click, 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 they know that I've click, click, clicked. And, you know, they know that I'm a stronger supporter than perhaps they thought. So I'm going to get more of these. And, you know, it feeds on itself. What's the point of all this? It's that the election, Ronald Reagan really started the technique of campaigning after the election stopped. He campaigned for tax cuts. He campaigned, ironically, for budget reduction. That didn't work out so well for Reagan. But he used the same techniques of the electoral campaign, and he did that through advertising, through television. Well, now that campaign continues through these social networkings that Obama originally used for his electoral campaign.
And so where do you think it's going?
I mean,
you can look at, I'm looking at Bob McDonald's website now, and there's Facebook, YouTube, Flickr, Blip TV, Twitter. These are all links on the homepage of his campaign website. Clearly now, the internet is an enormous part of any campaign.
Right. And this is what happens. I mean, when Nixon did, well, it's actually Johnson who did that incredibly effective TV ad, then everybody started pouring more money into TV. It takes politicians maybe a little longer than it should to figure this out, but once somebody figures that out, then everybody's all over it, you know, for good. And where is it going? Well, I think it's going to connect. I think it's going to increasingly separate those engaged people from the non-engaged people. And one of the things that we need to remember, and again, another Pew study that was brought to my attention by Paul Friedman, a very good political scientist of Virginia. One of the things we need to remember is that people with higher incomes still participate at higher rates. People with lower incomes participate at lower rates. And all the digital magic in the world so far has not changed some of those demographic characteristics. We know that older people participate in politics more than younger people. That's in part because they don't move as often. We know that people who move a lot don't participate in politics as much. These kind of truisms over the last 20 or 30 years, I think, are going to endure in spite of all the digital wizardry.
Yeah.
And we used to think it was just an access thing. Wealthy people have access, poor people don't. It's no longer that simple. It's more a matter of how are different groups of people using the access that they have. That's not to say that we can't make improvements on people people who live out in rural places like Louisa County having good access to the internet.
Yeah. Well, and we oftentimes sometimes forget that not everybody gets the internet.
That's right.
Millions of people in America that don't go home to computers.
Right. Now, that's exactly right. Now, there's a dark side, if you will, or a negative for Obama. You know, part of what happens when you invite participation, and the Obama campaign site had this blog, write to Barack, all that stuff. Well, part of what happens is you can't control as easily what is up on your website. So when Obama kind of midway through the campaign began to take more moderate positions as he moved to the middle, this is in the general campaign, some of the people who had been his strongest supporters, what did they use? What medium did they use to criticize Obama? They used his own website. So you could go to myobama.com and see all the vitriol that you talked about, not coming from birthers, yeah. Not coming from the far right, but coming from farther left, former supporters of Obama, right there on his website were all kinds of criticisms. So with this kind of openness and connectivity comes less ability to stay on message, control the message.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff, and it's just changing as we speak.
It is.
They're trying to keep up with it. Brian Ballow is a professor of history at the University of Virginia and director of the National Dissertation Fellowship Program at the Miller Center of Public Affairs. You can learn more online at millercenter.org. Brian, thank you for being here. Fascinating stuff.
Always fun, Coy. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit sevillepodcast.com for more.